watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft time
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The World Economic Forum, according to its website, is a member-based institution comprised of the heads of the 1,000 most powerful corporations in the world. Essentially, its goal is to homogenize economic and governmental systems worldwide in a manner that benefits corporations and their investors. This process is known as globalization. The WEF claims it is working to benefit humanity by creating prosperity through this system. The reality is that most of humanity has suffered greatly as a result of the WEF's agenda. While a small group of investors, corporate leaders, and their political allies have accrued enormous wealth. They have done this through the smoke and mirrors process known as free trade, which is neither free nor trade. It's a process of moving production to subsidiaries or contracting companies located in a country where the workers are paid slave wages and kept from rebelling by a government that gets a cut of the action. These products are then shipped back to the U.S. and called trade. Meanwhile, these corporations leave in their wake destroyed lives and poisoned land as they hop from country to country for their next quick buck. This coming week, the World Economic Forum will meet at the swanky Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, where members will gorge themselves on delicious food and fine wines, pat themselves on the back, and plan how to do more of the same. Our so-called democratically elected leaders, far from putting a stop to this corporate rampage, will be there on bended knee, offering them more U.S. taxpayer dollars robbed from hardworking people, offering them U.S. troops to keep their victims suppressed all over the world, offering them the protection of the New York City police, which stands ready to beat the living daylights out of the protesters that are converging on New York City to confront them. If this description of events seems exaggerated, it's only because you haven't heard stories like the one you're about to hear on your evening TV news.
Maine has seen the continual closure of production plants as production is moved out of the country. Dexter Shoe in Dexter closed its last plant this December 28th, moving production to China. 560 people lost their jobs. 110 people lost their jobs last week when the Saucony Shoe plant in Bangor, Maine, moved its production to China as well. Workers collected their final paychecks today. We have with us in the studio Jack McKay, and soon we'll have some of the Saucony workers joining us on the phone line. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you.
So before we talk with the workers, would you like to give us in a nutshell what the situation is now?
Congress is going to reconvene January 23rd, and the first thing on their table, according to a number of reports, is the economic stimulus package. Senators Snow and Collins have really trumpeted a plan that they have, which we think is very poor for workers. The most important thing at this point for the 1,000 workers who are laid off right now in the greater Bangor area is health insurance and increasing the unemployment benefits. And this is after talking to workers and doing dozens of house calls and talking to literally hundreds of workers. So we think it's very important that the senators hear from us, and we're in the middle of an organizing effort to really make democracy work. It's as simple as that.
Do you want to touch briefly on what the difference is between Collins and Snow's, the bill they might maybe supporting, and the alternative?
Sure. And this is very much a case where the devil's in the details. On the competing proposal, which passed the Senate Finance Committee, is actually voted against by Senators Snow and Collins on November 14th. It would entail that the workers to pay their COBRA, which is their health insurance payments. You have a right to continue health insurance after you've been laid off, provided that you pay 102% of the premiums. So for workers in Passanumpkin and Costigan, that's $800 a month. For Saucony, that's $700 a month. For Dexter, that's $530 a month. With unemployment benefits at roughly $250 a week, this is impossible to do. So the Senate finance plan was that workers would pay 25%, which on $700 is roughly $175, directly to the health insurance company. The health insurance company, in turn, would get the remaining 75% from the federal government. So the workers' responsibility is to write the check, and that's it. And the health insurance company is required to provide the health insurance. Very simple. No new regulations. For the Snow-Collins plan, however, which they are trumpeting is immediately responding to workers, it's smoke and mirrors. It's the reality is very different. Workers have to go down to the unemployment office, fill out forms, prove that they've made their COBRA payments, their health insurance payments, and then wait for the check from the federal government. Well, it was very interesting because Senator Snow was having a roundtable discussion on security issues and also her economic stimulus plan, as well as, which entails jobs and the layoff benefits. I went there along with the vice president of the Central Labor Council, Roxanne Munksgaard, and an intern. Now, at this roundtable discussion, there were the mayors from all the surrounding communities of Bangor, the chiefs of police and fire, as well as people from the hospitals, St. Joe and Eastern Maine Medical. Basically, the issue for those folks around the table was they had incurred extra costs, they'd spent extra money due to September 11th for the police that beefed up security, for the hospitals there was work on their decontamination facilities, as well as creating facilities to handle hazardous biochemical attacks, etc. So the number one issue for folks there was not getting money from the federal government. The only people there speaking for progressive issues or working class issues were myself and two other people. That was it. So, and we were the bearers of bad news. People were very happy. They were sort of laughing and joking about how they're going to get money from the federal government. And then towards the end of the meeting, Senator Snow talked about how great her economic stimulus package was. So at that point, we raised our hands. I raised my hand. And it began to have a conversation with the senator. She tried to basically shift the discussion to people who are COBRA ineligible. And those are people who have not worked at the plant for a year. We had to keep her back on the subject. What basically happened was is she said that, it's very easy for people to get their unemployment benefits, the COBRA payments. All they have to do is go down to the unemployment office and apply for it. And I said, well, how does that actually work? Do they have, checks, voucher checks that they're going to write out to people when they get to the unemployment office? And how do they know at the unemployment office whether or not somebody's made their health insurance payment? Well, Senator Snow couldn't answer that except to say, well, the regulations haven't been made, which really caused a silence in the room because it was clear that what she was asking is for workers to trust that the federal government was going to send the money immediately. And to say this with a straight face in front of a room full of the elected leadership and powerful people in the Bangor area is something that's possible was absolutely absurd. So being an astute politician, she changed her position and said, this is something we would consider.
Jeanette, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Thanks for joining us.
My name is Jeanette Seeger, and I was just laid off from Saucony here in Bangor, which is a shoe factory, and I was employed there for 21 years. And now I find myself without employment.
What happened to the jobs at Saucony?
Well, we were told that everything has gone overseas, so they had to close our factory.
And 110 people lost their jobs, and that was just last week.
Last week, no. There was, I think it was like 63 or 64 of us, because there was some that had gotten laid off in November.
I see. So. Had you had any notice at all? Or?
Well, we were the last crew there, so we worked the, what they call the closeout notice, which mm-hmm. was a two-month notice,
yep.
60 days.
Do you want to just give us an idea of what it's like right now?
Well, for one thing, it's very scary. I'm going to be 53 years old, and jobs are not as easy to find when you're, you know, older. And I've been working at this company for 21 years, so for me to find, you know, if I wanted to look for another job in the shoe industry, that doesn't hold much hope for me because all the shoe industry is closing down. Everywhere you see, they're closing factories down in the state of Maine. Right now, my husband is also unemployed, so it's, you know, that's even scarier because, you know, mm-hmm. getting my unemployment started and everything, and then I'm on medication, you know, 3-4 kinds of medication that I have to take every day, and I have a problem with my blood, and they have to do blood work, so I'm in need of blood tests all the time, and my insurance is going to be running out the 10th of next month. I won't have no more medical insurance whatsoever.
Jeanette, do you think that the politicians and the CEOs of the companies and the people who have power over these things are hearing your concerns? Do you think they have any idea of what it's like to be in your shoes right now?
No, I really don't. I don't see how anybody that earns a six-figure income could have any idea what it's like to not have a job and not be able to pay for medical insurance and living paycheck to paycheck. I don't see how they could understand what a regular worker has to go through. That's something you'd have to live it in order to understand it.
So you won't be having any health insurance at all right now then? Is that what it
means? Right now I still have my health insurance. It's still good until February 10th.
But after that?
After that I will no longer have any medical insurance.
Because you won't be able to afford it with the
I can't afford $700 a month for payment for what it would cost me for my family, for my husband and myself.
If you, go ahead.
Well, I just want to clarify something that Jack was saying earlier and get your input on this too, Jeanette. You're saying that what people would have to do if they followed the proposed plan is they would have to pay out of pocket their insurance and then wait for the government to reimburse them. And all of this on a $250 a week check from
my check's not going to be $250 a week.
So yeah, $250 is like the upper limit.
It's under $200.
So wow. You have to pay your insurance and then just wait for this check from the government in the meantime, survive somehow.
I don't even get enough money to pay the medical insurance with mm-hmm. my check. What I'm getting for unemployment check, I wouldn't even have enough money with just my unemployment check to cover my medical insurance. That's not counting my living expenses.
Right.
And my rent and my food and my, you know, fuel and all that stuff.
Mm. And if you could share with us, because you were saying earlier that, and refresh my memory on this, is that you pay 10% of your medication, and how much does that cost?
10% of my medication for just myself, mm-hmm. If I get a month supply, it's $12 a prescription. If I get a three-month supply, it's $24 a prescription. So you figure if I have three prescriptions to fill, that's $75.
Mm.
And if my husband has three prescriptions to fill, that's another $75. That's $150 out-of-pocket money. That's just 10% of what my prescriptions cost. If I had to pay the full amount, it would be, you know, astronomical. There's just no way I could have my medical. My medicine, and the medicine that I'm on, I cannot be off. I have to take it every single day. And the medicine that there's one medication that I have to take once a week. And my husband's medication that he's on, he has to take every single day.
Mm.
It's not something he can just not take.
Mm. So that totals $150 a month. So without mm-hmm. the health insurance, that's
$1,050. That's $150 for a three-month supply.
Okay.
But once my insurance runs out, I have to pay out-of-pocket money for my medical, my prescriptions,
right.
And it's going to be a lot more than that.
Mm.
It could be, I know one of my husband's things is $44 a piece for one, he's on an inhaler, and it's $44 a piece for one inhaler, and that doesn't even last him a month.
Huh.
So you can see the difference as far as the prices go.
And I'm curious, on the wages that you received at Saucony, and I'm sure this is true with everybody, were you able to save up a lot of money to take care of these things?
No.
No?
No, we were living from paycheck to paycheck, you know, meeting our bills.
Because I think I was told that the pay at Saucony was about, what, $8, $9 an hour?
Yeah, but when you've been an employee for 21 years and you're making $8 an hour, that's not a lot of money.
No.
Right.
For 21 years of service, if you stop and think about it.
No, I think a living wage in Maine is something like $14 an hour.
Right, and I was earning more money when I was a piece worker than I am as a, you know, a regular. You know, when they took our piece work away from us,
mm-hmm.
I lost, you know, $2-3 per hour.
So, what have they told you? Because there's been some displaced workers programs that you've gone through. What's going to happen when your insurance runs out?
My medical insurance?
Right.
I don't have any medical insurance. There's no way I can afford to pay for COBRA. I mean, COBRA would be available to us, but I don't have $700 and some odd to pay for that per month.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that money.
And what have they told you can do?
What am I going to do?
Yeah.
I have no idea. I've got to see if I can find some help from someplace.
Mm.
I have no idea. This is just something that I'm starting to do now, trying to figure out, you know, where the help's going to come for me to get, you know, and this is just prescription medication. I'm not even talking about if I get hurt or if my husband gets hurt or if we get ill and we have to go to the hospital or, you know. I'm just grateful that I had medical insurance when I went through what I went through last year.
Mm.
Because if I hadn't, I'd really be in a boat.
Jeanette, if you could give a message to Collins or Snow or the Congress right now, what is it that you feel would be able to help you and other people like you?
I think first and foremost is that they need to be honest. They need to tell us exactly what's going on and not try to sugarcoat everything to cover up for what they're doing. And I think they need to start supporting the people of Maine. If they're supposed to be working for the people of Maine to help the people of Maine, and if they're doing that, then they need to support whatever, if they're fighting for a bill or whatever they're fighting for to help that will benefit the people of Maine, the people that have been laid off, the people that are out of work, then that's what they need to pass that bill if that's going to help us, and not have them vote against it.
Mm.
And you're one of many workers that are in the same boat, Jeanette. Are you all pulling together and trying to organize yourselves to address some of these issues?
We're trying to.
Mm.
You know, we went to a, you know, we're getting informed and trying to get information as to know what to do, what we need to do as individuals to help ourselves in order to help, you know, get this stuff done.
And I just want to, you know, really hit on one point to be, you know, that the folks really know about this. What you're saying, Jeanette, is that, you know, here we are in the richest country in the world. you're looking at, you know, your shoe plant has shut down, and this is this, and I'm sure this story is the same for the 1,000 other workers. You're looking at, you know, it's absolutely impossible to pay $700 for health insurance on $1,000 unemployment benefits.
And it's not even $1,000.
Yeah.
You figure if you get unemployment benefits, say I was getting $200 per week unemployment benefits.
Mm-hmm.
That's only $800 a month. If my medical insurance is $700+, what do I live on?
Absolutely impossible. And you have
and
you have prescription medication, which literally you and your husband, your life depends on it.
Yes.
And with people coming in, and I saw there was a representative, Senator Snow, and I saw there was a representative, Senator Collins, at the meeting, as well as other people from the state, and they could tell you nothing to do come February 10th. They couldn't advise you on any sort of plan.
No.
So you're in a life-threatening situation, and they're being of zero help.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And basically, that's exactly what's happening. And they have no understanding of what is really happening to the people of Maine. They say they do, but they don't.
And I'm sure there's dozens of people around the Bangor area who are also facing a life-threatening event. And Jeanette, have you seen anything about this on the news or in the newspapers?
I haven't seen anything on the news about the fact that they even closed our plant down. There was a little something when we had the first layoff, but nothing has been mentioned about our, you know, the other works that have been laid off because of the plant closing. You know, this is not something that we're only off for a couple of weeks here. This plant is no longer here. It's as, you know, as of now, as far as we're concerned right now, they're not going to call us back in 2 weeks and say, you can come back to work, your job is back. It's not happening. You know what I mean? You know, so I have to find something else that will pay me at least the amount of money that I was earning there with some semblance of medical benefits that I can, you know.
And Jeanette, I actually heard from somebody at Saucony that there's a group of Chinese businessmen who recently in the past year, there's a group of something like 8 who stood there and watched workers do every step of the job and wrote down what those processes were. Were you able to see that also? Or?
No, I can't really say that I knew that there was Chinese, you know, there were men there, but they weren't in my area of where I was working. So.
Okay. Now, the Dexter Shoe jobs are going to China. They're actually shutting down their jobs, their plant, the Dexter plant in the Dominican Republic, because that's too expensive and moving the jobs to China. It's interesting to note that both Senators Snow and Collins voted for permanent normal trade relationships with China, which sort of stabilized the trading relationship with China so that more and more of these jobs are going there. And I find it pretty hypocritical that you know, Bush is able to get up and say that trade creates jobs, and Senator Collins said about a month ago that the lowering of trade barriers has created thousands of jobs in Maine. And I think it's just extremely, extremely sad that we have one of the highest elected people in our state who's able to say something that's so false that thousands of jobs are created in Maine because of a trade at the exact time that we've lost 1,000 jobs in the Bangor area because of trade.
Just
Dexter,
in Bangor area.
Saucony, Pastumke, Costigan will all be certified to have shut down and moved because of trade. And Collins is able to make these statements, which are just simply false, and she's able to get away with it. I mean, it makes me a little bit upset with you know, the way things are going.
Well, this is why I said, you know, that first and foremost is that we need honesty. You know, I know that, you know, they expect people to be honest, and we should, we have a right as U.S. citizens to demand honesty from our government.
After September 11th, they passed a bill for $15 billion for the airline companies and not a penny for the 140,000 workers who lost their jobs, just lost so much in several years. You know, this is our country, and the proposals they're having go through are not good for workers in our community. 77% of Snow Collins' proposal goes to corporations in the top 25%. And people are standing up and saying, you know, this is our country, this is a democracy, and this isn't going to be a good thing for us. And this is globalization striking a body blow in our backyard, a body blow to our neighbors, to our relatives, to our friends. And it's time that we stand up and did something about it.
That was former Saucony shoe worker Jeanette Seeger and Jack McKay of the Central Maine Labor Committee speaking with Meredith DeFrancesco and Amy Brown of WERU in Maine about the effects of recent plant closings and layoffs in Bangor. As we just heard mentioned, U.S. taxpayer money taken out of the pockets of people like Jeanette Seeger was given to the owners and stockholders of U.S. Airlines. $15 billion worth. As of October 18th, the government had paid out $2.4 billion in cash assistance to 111 airlines, 83% of it to the top 9 airlines. There is $2.6 billion in cash left to pay out, in addition to $10 billion worth of federal loan guarantees. Why no gifts of money for the 140,000 airline workers who were given pink slips? Why no gifts of money for Jeanette Seeger and her husband? Let's look at a few numbers. Continental Airlines has received $191 million and laid off 12,000 people. Their CEO, Gordon M. Bethune, earned almost $14 million in the year 2000. United Airlines has received $391 million of your tax money and laid off 20,000 people. Their CEO, James Goodwin, earns about $2 million a year, about the same amount as the combined annual wages of the 1,000 laid-off shoe workers in Bangor, Maine. For more facts and figures on the $15 billion airline bailout, see www.recoverywatchdog.org. Recoverywatchdog.org. There are solutions to the problems of the 1,000 shoe workers in Maine, but Congress obviously refuses to take them. The shoe factory buildings are still in Bangor, as are the people who know how to make shoes. Congress could bail them out by buying the factory for the workers to run their own shoemaking cooperative. Not only would the laid-off workers benefit, the whole community of Bangor would benefit. Or Congress could make them deferred payment loans to buy the shoe factory. Why aren't they? Assuming that Jeanette and her husband don't die as a result of having to choose between medical care or a roof over their heads, what can they expect in the future? Much the same has happened to the people of Syracuse when General Electric fled New York just as the ink was drying on the so-called North American Free Trade Agreement. They were either forced to leave their hometown in search of work elsewhere or do double shifts for minimum wage at a convenience store. For inflicting this misery on thousands of people in New York State and poisoning our waterways in the bargain, former General Electric CEO Jack Welch is the darling of the business world, hailed as a pioneer and an innovator. Newsweek magazine once called him the most heartless CEO in corporate America. If the attitude the GE employees had towards Jack Welch is any indication of what kind of man he is, then that remark is a vast understatement. According to former GE employees in Syracuse, New York, Jack Welch was so hated by his employees that on the rare occasions he would come to inspect the plants in Syracuse, he would be constantly accompanied by armed plainclothes security for fear of being assassinated by one of his workers. And he would take a helicopter directly to and from the plant to the airport. Next, Wizards of Money shines a spotlight on Jack Welch and his amazing success story.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of a whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is the Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series. But with a twist, my name is Smithy and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is part 9 of the Wizards of Money series and it is entitled Jack and the Sweatshop. In this, the 9th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at the manager of the 20th century, Jack Welch, General Electric CEO for the 20 years up until fall of 2001. In September 2001, Jack's much-awaited autobiography entitled Jack Straight from the Gut was released with much fanfare. Business professionals are beside themselves with praise for the book. For example, Warren Buffett's comments are that, quote, all CEOs want to emulate him, end quote. The chairman of Sony Corporation stated, quote, Jack Welch, the brilliant business magician, has finally disclosed his mysteries of management, end quote. Since Jack is a brilliant business magician, and since during his watch he transformed GE's small credit company into GE Capital, the largest non-bank financial institution in the world, and almost half of the modern GE, he is definitely one of the most important wizards of the 20th century. In the midst of the gushing reviews of Jack's book, his career and management style, it is important to analyze his influence on corporate culture in America. From his ability in the 1980s to turn mass firings of employees from an attack on communities into an almost saintly act of saving companies from inefficiency to the 1990s trend of establishing high-tech sweatshops overseas, Jack has built a new model of the American corporation. In this new model, the only US employees are managers. These managers get churned out at the so-called People Factory in Crotonville, New York, also known as Jack's Cathedral, and they manage the overseas units where the real work is done at optimal cost. The other key part of the US operation is the Capital Factory, GE Capital, the company's own mini Wall Street. With most real production done outside of the corporation, what does GE actually produce? What is the measure by which GE is acclaimed to be the great success of the 20th century? Is it great light bulbs, great engines, great electricity, or is it something else? It's earnings. GE is the best manufacturer of earnings in the 20th century. It has the sexiest looking balance sheet and income statement bookkeeping entries of all. Recall that we spoke extensively about the earnings manufacturing business in Wizards Part 8. You can get all past editions of The Wizards of Money at www.wizardsofmoney.org. In this edition of Wizards, as we look at the cathedral that Jack built, we will be hearing some excerpts of an interview Jack did with Bob Joss at a Commonwealth Club event on November 12, 2001, with an audience of Stanford business students. At the other end of the spectrum, we will be hearing an interview I did on January 5, 2002, with Jessica Lindberg, housewife and mother in Rome, Georgia, on the banks of the PCB-laden Coosa River in North Georgia. She has been busy trying to get GE to clean up its mess in this North Georgia town, and she even confronted Jack at his final GE shareholder meeting as chairman about this issue. To get this episode underway and to give a brief overview of Jack's career and what it was all about, I found a fictional story, I'm not sure where it came from, that has some similarities with Jack Welch's story. The main character is also Jack, and a quick telling of this fictional story should help you get a handle on Mr. Welch's saga in a quick and easy to understand way. The fictional story is called Jack and the Corporate Ladder. This is the story called Jack and the Corporate Ladder. Some people call it Jack the Giant Killer. Once upon a time, there was a young man named Jack. He lived with his father and mother in Massachusetts, and they were a family of humble means. Jack's father was a railway conductor and was always very busy trying to earn a living for his family. So Jack spent a lot of time with his mother, whom he adored and who adored him. One day Jack left his dear mother and set off for the markets to find a job. He found one in the land of GE. After some years of hard work, some GE merchants offered Jack a trade that he didn't like, the same bonus level as his colleagues, and so he decided to quit. But then a more crafty merchant offered Jack a handful of better treats, a larger bonus, and some special treatment in return for Jack's future loyalty. Jack thought this was a pretty good deal, and so he went home, banked his bonus, and nurtured his ambition. The next day, he went back to work and saw a huge corporate ladder in sight. An ambitious fellow, Jack began the long climb to the top. Jack had heard that there were giants at the top of the corporate ladder, and that he might have to fight them when he got there. Well, he considered it all a big game, and he really wanted to win the game. He was really determined to deal with those giants when he got to the top. Along the way up the corporate ladder, Jack bumped into a giantish-looking fellow called Ronnie. Jack and Ronnie made good friends, and both were determined to kill the giants when they got to the top, for the giants interfered with freedom. They both agreed on that. However, about a quarter of the way up the top, Ronnie was thrown off the corporate ladder. The land of GE had important contracts with the giants, and Ronnie's constant chatter of giant killing was messing with these deals. Ronnie was determined to get to the top another way, so he started to set his sights on becoming the main giant at the top himself. Meanwhile, Jack continued his journey to the top of the corporate ladder. Finally, Jack got to the top, and there he could see huge amounts of riches and treasures in this new land that he considered rightfully his. But there were some battles to be fought and won in order to claim those riches for himself. Well, first there was the issue of giants. Not long after he arrived, Jack bumped into the leading giant of the land, only to find out that it was his friend Ronnie, who had also just made it to the land of the top. Jack couldn't be more pleased at this. Together, Jack and Ronnie vowed to rid the land of the rest of the giants so that the riches could be theirs. Only, there were a few other things in the way. Standing between them and the riches were thousands of annoying little creatures that were also trying to get a bit of the riches for themselves. These annoying critters were called jobs, and Jack immediately set to killing the ones he really didn't like and banishing the rest to lands far, far away. Subsequent to that, Jack thought he better set up a people factory so he could churn out people to behave exactly how he wanted them to. Jack used the people factory to build something of an army to help him get across to the riches and wipe out any other unexpected obstacles along the way. More trouble arose when Jack and his army got to the land of the media, where nasty stories were spreading about Jack the job killer, and they even called him Neutron Jack for his ability to kill jobs and leave buildings standing. This really upset Jack. He was only trying to get what was rightfully his. He put a stop to all this by invading the land of the media and taking over a good chunk of it for himself. Over the next few years, Jack and his army collected a huge amount of the riches for themselves. But then they came to the big river crossing, where they met a hostile giant who wanted to take a bunch of their riches. Ronnie was no longer around to help them with this giant. Jack and his army fought a long, hard, nasty battle for more than 20 years, but they finally lost and had to concede some riches to the giant. Never mind, Jack and his army just went and found other riches they could take. Jack was getting pretty old by this time and thinking about retiring from the big game when he came across yet another hostile giant. This one was from a land far, far away and approached Jack saying, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the makings of a vertical monopoly." This new giant seemed to exhaust Jack, and he retired from his life of giant killing with all the riches he had accumulated along the way. That's the end of the story called Jack and the Corporate Ladder. Now back to the real Jack Welch. How does his mind work? How does he justify mass layoffs, the pressuring of contractors to lay off workers and move factories to Mexico, the stingy wages in the high-tech sweatshops in India, and the constant denial that EPA-rated probable carcinogens are perfectly safe? Well, we'll let Jack explain this in his own words. Here is an excerpt from the November 12, 2001 Commonwealth Club interview with Jack Welch.
One of the things that I get challenged on a lot is winning. Somehow or other, people think winning is bad. It's all about winning. Business is a game. Business is a game where you field the best team, and the team that fields the best players wins the game. And what do? They pay taxes. They celebrate. Employees give back to the community. The company gives back to the community. They're good citizens. All these things happen. What happens when a company misses and loses? No one's popping champagne in the dugouts. No, everyone has got job insecurities. All these things occur, and yet people say, winning is such a crass thing. Winning is what it's about. That's when you can give back. That's when you become a valued member of society. I used to run the United Ways in the New York area. And you'd go in the tri-state area calling on companies in a recession. I remember going in 82. And you'd show up at the door, the guy said, "Jesus, I'm sorry, I can't help you this year. Things are really tough." And that happens over and over again. So my challenge to all of you is, don't be embarrassed by winning. Love winning. Create excitement around winning.
It appears that in his own mind, Jack is unable to separate what he does from a baseball game or a good golf game. Under his logic, the team can only do good if it beats everybody else. The scorecard is the earnings report, the abstract has become the real, and the real has become completely abstract. Of course, Jack doesn't know what it feels like to be on the receiving end of his big game, big business decisions. He doesn't know what it's like to be laid off, to work in an overseas sweatshop, or to live in a toxic wasteland that nobody wants to clean up. This other side is perhaps the losing team in Jack's mind. Certainly, the losing team in Jack's game doesn't see this business as a game. Jack never mentions in his book, nor in his interview, the rather large handicap he is given by the American taxpayer in this game of business. Tax breaks, subsidies, accounting wizardry, media ownership, and your very own mini Wall Street created through years of favored access to credit can all help tremendously. To link this episode with Wizards Part 8, let's take a look at the aftermath of the Enron collapse as an example of gifts to GE provided by the taxpayer. In Wizards Part 8, we touch briefly on Enron's power operations in India. Partners of Enron in this operation were none other than GE Capital and the Bechtel Corporation. Why them, you might ask? Well, for many years, GE has taken advantage of the opportunities for high-tech sweatshops in India. India has millions of well-educated, technically trained, English-speaking people that cost mere peanuts compared to US workers. Consequently, GE has now exported all kinds of technical operations to India, from data entry to accounting to customer service to loans and claims processing and, of course, computer programming. But for years, Jack was frustrated. He had the cheap bodies in India, but he didn't have the electricity to power the high-tech sweatshops. Similarly, Bechtel Corporation moved engineering operations to India, and the engineers needed electricity too. On Jack's September 2000 visit to India, he is quoted by The Telegraph as saying, quote, "When you think of digitizing India, there will be a massive amount of power required. And I pray to this government that you have to push and push and push to invest in infrastructure." End quote. The Enron GE Bechtel venture into Indian electricity production seemed to start off promising enough. But in 2001, the main purchaser of this electricity, the Maharashtra state government, stopped paying its bills, partly contributing to Enron's problems. Then, with all its other problems, Enron finally collapsed and things looked grim for the three patrons of high-tech sweatshop electricity. Crying over their losses, they all went to the US government last month to ask for almost $250 million compensation from the US taxpayer. Yes, this is really true. Fact is stranger than fiction. A December 20th, 2001, Dow Jones Newswire article that went almost completely unnoticed reported that three US giants had made a claim to the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, an agency of the US government, for $200 million in what is known as expropriation compensation. Well, that's globalization for you. The star of our show today is, of course, the king of globalization. So, on this topic, let's see what Jack Welch himself has to say about globalization. At the November 12th Commonwealth Club event, people were allowed to ask some questions. No, not the questions they really wanted to ask, don't be silly. When it comes to questions to business gurus in the free world these days, the methodology runs as follows. You submit your questions on paper in advance, and then a committee decides which are the appropriate questions, and then they get reworded to optimize their appropriateness. This seemed to be going on in most corporations, and also, of course, for government gurus. And so it was with questions at this Commonwealth Club event Even though it was a very safe audience, it was Stanford business students mostly. But then Jack had probably thought that the audience at the annual shareholders meeting in Atlanta earlier that year was probably safe too, but a real question did slip through the cracks. We'll hear more about this later. Anyway, the following question on globalization versus democracy, posed to Jack at the Commonwealth Club event, was probably the closest that one came to a real question. Please listen carefully to Jack's response.
Here's a really big picture question, Jack. How do you reconcile the conflict, assuming you see a conflict, between democracy and the corporate culture of globalization?
Oh, I think that's pretty easy. I happen to believe globalization is a great thing. I happen to believe that globalization is the best chance in the world for the have-nots to become haves. I'll give you a country that I'm more familiar with, being a thick Irishman. Take Ireland. Look at Ireland 20 years ago. It had nothing. American businesses came there. Businesses came from the continent. Today, Ireland is thriving. Great GDP growth. Great income per capita. Ireland's now wondering, hey, Jack, what do we do? Gateway just announced that they're moving a big factory to India. I said, welcome to globalization. You're moving up the food chain. You've got to invest more in technology. You've got to invest more in knowledge. You've got to reinvest in that. Now, globalization has not solved all the world's problems. It has not cured cancer. It has clearly not reached parts of the subcontinent. It didn't reach Afghanistan. It didn't reach another. I understand some of the critics' views of globalization, but only one. That's the labor unions in developed countries. They run the threat of losing jobs, low value-added jobs. They have a basic argument. I don't understand the environmentalist view of it, because every place you go, you bring world-class standards, and you put factories in that are better than anything in the country, and people bring, and the neighborhood gets better. So I don't understand that argument. That argument falls on deaf ears with me, because every U.S. company that goes to a country brings world-class environmental standards. Now, it hasn't cured everything, though. And it needs to get broader, it needs to get better, but it shouldn't be the whipping man or woman for war, for other things. It has given more to the have-nots than anything yet invented. Anything yet invented. If you remember something better, it's done better than the UN has, it's done better than the zillion organizations have in improving the lives of millions of people. Go to Prague. Go to Budapest. Go to East Berlin. Go see these things. People are living far better than they ever dreamt, and because of globalization. Not that I care about the subject.
Let us take a good look at this issue of exporting world-class environmental standards and a little bit of a look at job exporting. We will now listen to an interview I did on January 5th this year with Jessica Lindberg, mother of two in the town of Rome, Georgia, who founded a group there called Citizens Action Network. Rome is in the northwest corner of Georgia, between Atlanta, Georgia, and Chattanooga, Tennessee. It is also not far from a town called Anniston in Alabama that has received a lot of national attention lately. For about 40 years, GE operated a medium transformer manufacturing plant in Rome, Georgia. For about half of those years, it dumped its waste products into several landfills and waterways of Rome. After NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement, came into effect in 1994, GE didn't waste any time. They promptly moved operations to Mexico and left their PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, and their dioxins, the killer chemical in Agent Orange, and many other chemical cocktails behind. In contrast to Anniston, Alabama, in contrast to the Hudson River in New York and the situation in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. The Rome, Georgia toxicity problems get scant media attention, both in the mainstream and in the independent media. Yet, this story is so important. In the following interview, note that the EPD is the Environmental Protection Division, an environmental enforcement agency of the Georgia state government. I started the interview by asking Jessica Lindberg how she came to form the Rome, Georgia-based Citizens Action Network.
I got involved in September of 2000 after an article in the Rome News Tribune talking about the presence of PCBs and other potential toxins in the creek close to my house. And I have two young children, and I was concerned about their safety. So I got involved with another professor, a professor at Floyd College, and we started to talk about what we could do, and our first priority was to see how many other people knew about this and were concerned enough to try to do something to speed up the cleanup process. And that's how we formed Citizens Action Network.
And can you talk about whereabouts the GE site is, what was actually done at the factory, and how you first found out about the PCBs, especially in relation to where your kids go to school and where they play?
I didn't know very much about PCBs. In fact, I'd never heard the term before the article in the Rome News Tribune. So I had a lot of self-education to do on that. But, of course, as any mother, when you read in the paper that there may be a potential cancer-causing agent in the park where your children are playing, you're going to do everything you possibly can to get rid of it and to find out about it. It didn't matter to me that it was potential cancer-causing. It was just that it was there in the first place, mm-hmm. and it needed to be gone, and I didn't understand why they couldn't just come scoop it out and make it go away. At the plant, which is, I'm not very good at distances, a couple of miles from my house, to the west, they had several runoff creeks and tributaries, one of which was Little Dry Creek, which runs through the park that's close to my house. And from 1952 to 1977 or 76, they manufactured medium transformers at that plant using pyranol, as the which contained the PCBs, mm-hmm. As the liquid in the transformers. And a lot of that a lot of that waste and runoff went directly into storm drains and runoff and tributaries from the property. So a lot of it got out into the community that way. The other way it got out into the community was that GE gave it away to employees and friends of employees in 50-gallon drums, mm-hmm. To take home and use as termite treatment for their houses, or painted on fence posts for getting rid of termites, or spreading on dusty roads to keep the dust down, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. There's also an issue, I think it's unique to Rome, where the PCBs have actually entered the groundwater, which I don't know. I don't believe that's an issue with the Hudson River case or the Pittsfield, Massachusetts case. Can you talk about what's going on there? How have the PCBs entered the groundwater? And also, the other places where the PCBs are, such as in the soil, throughout the soil, how did it get there?
I can talk more about the soil than I can about the groundwater. Mm. The soil was from the homeowners taking it home.
Okay.
And using it on their houses. The homeowners at the time, the people who took it home, had no reason to believe that there was anything wrong with it.
Back to the groundwater issue, I know you said you didn't know much about it, but you actually gave a good description before of how the groundwater enters, once it seeps into the soil, how the groundwater goes into, say, underground aquifers. It's very different to what GE's faced in the northern states. And can you talk about in the northwest corner of Georgia, when water enters the soil, how does it sort of seep into the ground?
Well, it's mostly limestone, mm-hmm. and it's karst topography, which means that limestone dissolves and there's all these little holes everywhere, and there could be great pools of water, standing groundwater in different areas, and along with that, the chemicals that we don't want there. And it's extremely hard to track
so where it all is anywhere, and where it's going. And you don't know where it is. Which is very different to the Hudson, where they're pretty sure that it's, it's confined to that area around the river.
GE continues to say that that kind of topography does not exist on this site, and that's another question that's up for debate.
So that would make it unique to the rest of northwest Georgia? Okay. It seems to me that the issue in Rome is not just PCBs, but a number of other chemicals that were coming off the site, including dioxins, which is a known carcinogen, at least if it's not formally known as one, it's informally known as one. Furans, is that
what? Furans.
Furans, chlorinated benzenes, and so forth. Has GE admitted that those things are an issue, and what is going on with respect to
I have never heard them admit that that is an issue. What I've heard them say over and over again is that dioxins are a byproduct of PCBs burning at high temperatures. And what I've heard them say over and over again is that they never got hot enough to create dioxins. And I've heard them say these dioxins are coming from other places, perhaps the carpet mills or whatever. I've never heard them directly say these were responsible for these dioxins. I know that dioxins have been found in several places off-site, but I don't know what's happened since then.
It's my understanding from looking through some of the documents, there was a public comment period on one of the permit changes, and looking at some of the documents coming out of that, that the EP, the Georgia Environmental Protection Division, now has information that dioxins are an issue in this area, perhaps in contrast to what GE's been saying about dioxins, and that they are now mandated to test for dioxins, furans, chlorinated benzenes, and so forth.
But there has also been some testing for dioxins done by the EPA. And I think that they were the first ones to find them. I'm not sure. Or that it was testing that the EPA said the EPD had to do.
One of the reasons that I started looking into this issue, I spent a lot of time in North Georgia. I meet a lot of people from Rome, and I was stunned to find out how many people I kept meeting from Rome who had some kind of serious cancer problem in their immediate family. Can you talk about the sort of the funny things that are going on in Rome in certain areas near the site, and the stories that are coming out about cancer and other health problems?
The stories I've heard over and over again are various forms of cancer, mostly pancreatic cancer. Lots of brain tumors or mysterious brain illnesses that sound to me like when they're described as nervous disorders or functions of the nervous system collapsing. The other really disturbing thing for me as a mother that I've heard over and over again are the high instances of miscarriages or children born with birth defects or stillborns. And children dying, which, you know, is always upsetting.
Really?
But there's this one little pocket neighborhood that we walked through across from the GE plant and just heard. We walked through the neighborhood with one of the people who lives there, and every house we walked by he pointed to and listed some horrible tragic illness or something that had happened in that family. And he said he was filled with remorse that I think that he never did anything about it and that he was so trusting. But he said that that road, every time it rained, would back up, and the drains come from underneath the street. The culvert comes from underneath the street from the GE property straight onto this road, and the storm water runoff on the either side of the road would back up, and the children would all play in it.
Oh, really?
So, you know, that's this sort of funny thing that we heard over and over again that you can't confirm in any sort of study that we could fund.
Can you talk about what GE is actually doing, both about the Coosa River and the sites, which, just back to the groundwater issue, the groundwater issue is coming from one of the landfills where a lot of the dumping of the waste products were. What is GE doing to fix it up, and do people feel that that's enough?
I don't think anybody feels like it's enough simply because it's been 25 years. Mm-hmm. And we're working on groundwater and we're working on landfills. We haven't even gotten to the building. So, the fact that it's gone on for so long and we're just still where we are, mm-hmm. Is very indicative of the way this company works. It's the way they've done it in the Hudson to fight every step of the way.
Right.
They have done some good and quick things in the community that have helped their public relations here immensely. I can't say whether or not that's why they did them so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Things like when they found residents at high levels, when the residents would allow it, they cleaned it up immediately. They cleaned up the schools. They cleaned up West Central. I think there were some found at West End, too.
That's,
they cleaned up Tolbert Park. They cleaned up Tolbert Park more, actually, than the EPD required of them. The EPD had issued a letter saying it was clean, and they went back and did grid sampling and cleaned mm-hmm. it up even further. That was the one. Tolbert Park is where I live, and West Central is where my kids go to school, and that's where my focus was. And as a result of that, that's where the group's focus was.
But is the issue with the contaminated sites that nobody really knows how much contamination there is? That it's good and well to have examined these sites immediately neighboring the GE property, but now that they've cleaned up those particular sites, is the issue that there's still a lot of PCBs out there and all these other chemicals, and you just don't know where they are.
That has been our issue all along, mm-hmm. is that I've never understood why a company wouldn't say, oh, my gosh, we release these things and they're harmful. Let's clean up everything within 25-mile radius. Let's do a grid sampling on the whole city or the whole county. And, of course, they're not going to do that because that's not Jack Welch's GE.